Okay, since it's the ethics credit day, we'll start pretty much on time, so we get our ethics credit legally. We're really pleased that this is an annual tradition, and we're super pleased to continue it. We need this credit, and to have it tailored to bankruptcy and consumer bankruptcy is really wonderful. And today, in addition to Dr. Hieropoulos, who's been doing this for many years, we have Bill Weigel from the OLR. So he's got, of course, the expertise that we're all interested in hearing. And Bill indicated if you have something you want to ask him about privately afterwards, or if you don't get to something that you had wanted to talk about, he's, of course, willing to stick around and chat with you. Next month, January, we are not having a Lou Jones breakfast. We're skipping January. We're back on in February to revisit the lien stripping issue. And we're going to have Dwayne Wunsch, who represents title companies, come on in and give that perspective. So we're going to bring back our panel. I think Andy Golanowski's for sure agreed. I don't know about the other guys. Hopefully Jay might be willing to come back again. But again, we kind of scratched the surface. We got a lot of things kind of discussed. But we want to make sure that when you're stripping that lien, and the debtors 5 years later are trying to refinance or sell or do whatever, that they aren't going to have trouble. So that's our goal, and we're going to drill down a little bit more, and we'll have that title company perspective. So come on back in February. And again in February, we'll announce some other programs. We're looking at a litigation program. We're looking at some other great programs for our Lou Jones breakfast going forward. But today, again, and thanks to Paula and to Chris Wolk's sister for providing cookies. It's an annual tradition. Somebody said, we don't really have breakfast at the Lou Jones. Yes, we do. In December, we do. So that's great. Thank you, Paula. Thank you, Chris Wolk's sister. And thanks again to Bill and Jack for giving us our ethics credit today.
Hi, good morning, everybody. I'm Jack Hieropoulos, as Judge Kelly stated. I'm a staff attorney for Mary Grossman, who's one of the Chapter 13 trustees here in the Eastern District. Looking at Bill Weigel, who's litigation counsel at the Office of Lawyer Regulation. Bill is, of course, very knowledgeable about the OLR, so if you have any questions about procedure or anything while we're going through the outline, feel free to jump in and ask him any questions. I think he's open to answering anything that doesn't have to do with any pending matter before the OLR. So just to give you a quick overview of what we're going to try to talk about today, we're going to try to get through. We're going to go through some statistics about lawyer regulation. We're going to try to talk about two hypotheticals, and then Bill's going to tell some war stories that he's experienced in his position. So with that being said, I'll turn it over to you, Bill.
Okay, well, thanks. It's nice to be here. Thank you, Judge Kelly, and thank you, the attendees, whether you're in Oshkosh or Green Bay or Eau Claire, Godfrey and Conn, or hiding behind some of the pillars. I think people came up here to see what the line of sight was, and several people then chose their seating accordingly. But I enjoy coming out, and I'm really honored by the opportunity to speak to this group. I've never been in this room without cameras. I didn't know it was quite so formal. When I'm giving a talk or a presentation, I like wandering around and shuffling papers and freaking people out. And we're kind of tied, Jack and I, to the front of the room by virtue of the cameras here. The only other time I was in this room, I was had cameras as well. There was a OLR disciplinary case, and I think it was 1996 or 1997 that I tried. And it was former government official in Milwaukee, and it drew a little bit of media attention. So every 16 or 17 years, I guess I'll just keep coming on back here as long as anybody wants to welcome me. Jack and Judge Kelly both said something about me being knowledgeable. I think that was extraordinarily charitable. If I am, it's not brains, it's probably osmosis. I've been with the OLR, formerly BAPR, the Office of Lawyer Regulation. I'm sorry, like many of you, I'm from the world of government, so I start to speak in acronyms. But I've been with OLR for a little over 17 years now. Before that, I was an attorney in private practice here in the Milwaukee area. And as litigation counsel there, what I do is I'm kind of their chief prosecutor and kind of the general counsel. Whatever kind of lawsuit stuff might come up hits my desk, but a lot of that is the prosecution or public handling of attorney regulatory cases. Most of those are discipline cases. So I don't try as many now. We have 198 matters going in litigation right now, so I tend to manage the litigation much more so than actually get down and do trials, although I found myself in the Walworth courthouse a couple of weeks ago. Probably the first active trial this year. But I supervise disciplinary and reinstatement and medical incapacity cases, both trial level and on appeal. So I don't do investigative stuff. Again, I do lawsuit stuff. Truly, anytime there's a question, feel free to ask, feel free to interrupt, wave your arms, say, hey, Bill, that goes for anybody in any of the satellite offices as well. I think that people can get very boring. I can get really boring. I'm an ethics wonk about this stuff, and so you tend to, again, talk in your own area, and you can bore the more people to tears sometimes. I hope I don't do that with you for the next 45 minutes or so. But when talking about their own area and their own offices, as you tend to talk in numbers and acronyms and statistics and things, but Jack assured me that part of what this presentation should be is, what is the OLR, how does it work, how does it process things, what kinds of stuff or how many stuff do you get in? And I thought, sure, I can spin out some of that, and then let's maybe try to balance it out with some illustrations from real life, as one would call the war stories, which aren't ever set forth to make fun of anybody, except maybe the last one, which we'll talk about. That's not a Wisconsin attorney. But really, because as happens in almost any presentation that you get, any CLE presentation, 60 to 90% of it goes in one ear and out the other, and that's fine. But something sometimes strikes a chord. You say, wow, I've got one of those, or Susie could help me with that. Or maybe a year later you think, wow, what was that case again? I'll call that guy if I can find that outline and maybe get some guidance. And that's what Jack and I are here to do, is to not pound facts into your heads. I don't think that you'll necessarily be entirely ethically replenished by the time 9:30 rolls around on the clock in the clubhouse wall. But if there's something, you know, that grabs you a little bit, that's a good thing. And then that's a successful continuing legal education discussion. So we have a lot of material. I don't know if we'll get through it, because I don't know that we're necessarily trying to get through a particular outline. But I think by jumping from topic to topic a bit, we hopefully find something that is of interest to you, that is helpful to each of you in some way. By the way, any hard questions, I'm absolutely going to defer to Jack, because I know as much about bankruptcy as you can write on the head of a pen. I probably had my last 341 meeting representing a debtor sometime in the late 1980s. I was graduated from law school when I was 6 or 7, a very young person. But basic lawyer regulation statistics. Those of us who are licensed to practice law in Wisconsin, there's like 25,000 of you. There's a bunch of us. Most of us practicing here in Wisconsin. Some, of course, office elsewhere are having some kind of dual or multi-licensure. OLR is not a part of the State Bar of Wisconsin, which is a great group, but I'll call, you know, the mandatory trade group, basically. We're part of the court system. We're employees of the Supreme Court, which is an interesting place to be an employee of for the last couple of years particularly, and work as state employees. We receive about 2,500 grievances a year, and that's pretty steady year to year. When you start dealing in volume, you can not make up statistics, as 48.6% of people do when they just quote them off the top of their head. You can pretty much say these are good round numbers to rely on. Of those 2,400 grievances or so, many of them are received by telephone. Used to be kind of a written, almost lawyer-friendly system, where we would insist that a grievant had to file something in writing. In some other states, a grievant has to affirm or swear that what they're saying is true. Some of these people don't write very well. Some of them don't speak English. Many of them are understandably going to be very hesitant about getting into a rating battle with their lawyer or former lawyer. And so we now take the majority of our grievances by telephone. About 85% of those are resolved pretty quickly, within 85 days, within 90 days. A lot of them are not meritorious. A lot of them are just whining about results or about something that was not under the lawyer's control or doesn't implicate a rule of professional conduct. Or for some other reason is easily resolved. You know, I've called 4 times and he hasn't given me back my file. I've called 3 times on Monday and once earlier today. Well, you know, that's not going to be an ethical complaint. That's not an attorney who's failing to respond to reasonable requests for information. It's just a couple of phone calls over the course of a day or two. And we may pick up the phone and call that attorney. They're never real happy to hear from us. Hi, this is OLR. And say, Mrs. Smith called, she's talking about getting her file back because she switched attorneys. Can you make arrangements to do it? And the attorney says, yeah, I can get that done by the end of the week. We call Mrs. Smith, done deal. No ethical file started, no misconduct involved. A lot of them are resolved. Those that aren't resolved in that 85% grouping take quite a while to process. We're a regulatory agency. We're probably overladen with process and reviews and opportunities to be heard and to review what the other side is saying. And what that means is that investigations often take a year or sometimes more. At the conclusion of the investigation, if the agency goes to a probable cause body and they say, yeah, let's charge this person, that's when the file really hits my desk and that's when a public disciplinary complaint is filed. Last fiscal year, about 58 attorneys received public discipline, and there's always 45, 50 or so cases the Supreme Court decides. Every time that we file a public disciplinary complaint, the Supreme Court of Wisconsin will issue a written decision. It may say, you didn't prove your case dismissed, or it may find various misconduct and not others, and then discuss perhaps a precedent and impose some type of discipline.
Are those all published? Or?
Yeah, well, the ones in which they impose public discipline are published, and some of those that they dismiss are published as well. This sounds kind of oxymoronic, but hey, we're all government folk here. You can start a public disciplinary action, the conclusion of which the Supreme Court can decide to impose a private reprimand. What happens is that the complaint is public, the filings, the witness list, the motions, the briefing, sometimes the appeal. I had an oral argument that wound up with a private reprimand. And at the conclusion of the case, rather than issue an order which will be published in Callahan's or whatever, in the 2013 WIP, 642 or whatever the case publication is, site, they'll merely issue an order discussing the case and imposing the private reprimand. And then it's kind of an odd situation because I believe that any of you or Gary Spivak or somebody could walk into the clerk's office and say, hey, this is a public document. I want to see the final result of the case. And probably get a hold of that. If you would call OLR, we can't tell you about it because we can't discuss private discipline if there's no subsequent public discipline. Just like we can't discuss pending grievances or pending investigations or investigations closed with no public discipline imposed. Some attorney could have 14 grievances against her, and if you call up and say, like you ask about Susie Smith, and we say, she has no record of public discipline. Because there shouldn't be any presumption just because somebody has a grievance filed against her that she's a bad attorney or that there was misconduct there. You can see kind of, and still on page one, for which I apologize, but the breakdown in misconduct, there's revocations, there's suspensions of varying lengths. Revocation or a long suspension requires a specific petition for reinstatement and findings that the attorney is fit. There can be, as we said, private reprimands issued. Sometimes during the course of the investigation, something really doesn't rise to the level where you should prosecute any kind of a misconduct case. And there is an alternative to discipline, call it diversions, And that's usually for contract with the attorney whereby we provide some direction and guidance to some kind of remedial action that's going to help him or her, I don't know, fill in the blank, do criminal appeals better. Go take some CLEs on doing criminal appeals. Go take some CLEs on handling Chapter 13 cases. Provide us with your trust account records for a year or so we can know that we can trust you, because even though you weren't taking money, you're really doing a poor job with your paperwork. Things like that could be the, something that may result in a diversion.
Now, are those diversions something that they have to agree to?
That's something they have to agree to. It's really a contract. If they don't comply with the terms of the contract, then probably we're going to end up prosecuting them, even if we're seeking a low level of discipline, such as a private or public reprimand. On page 2, as Paul Harvey would say, there's a chart that came from our annual report. Criminal law and family law, like 50% of our business. A lot of reasons for that. Talk about that for an hour. But it's a little bit the nature of the case and the nature of the client and the nature of the attorneys. These are very hot button, high personal stakes issues. Oh my gosh, my liberty is going to be lost. I'm going to jail. Oh, she's going to take my kid. That's my kid. And it's very personalized. That's a real hot button type of case. And so it's a type of case where when things go south, a client is perhaps more inclined to file a grievance. Clients are also more inclined, I think, in those cases, to file grievances against the adverse attorney. That SOB that represents my husband, I'm filing, that prosecutor's no fair. He's engaging in prosecutorial misconduct, he must be. And so we start catching all these grievances. We're very aware of when somebody's trying to leverage the system for their own result or to assist in their own litigation. We get a lot of crammed letters from prisoners where what they want is not so much a misconduct finding against Attorney X, but something that might help them leverage this into a situation where there can be ineffective assistance of counsel found and perhaps a new trial in their matter. You can see that bankruptcy cases are only about 5% of the grievances that we receive. However, that means that every year in Wisconsin there are 100 plus people complaining about something in a bankruptcy matter, complaining about the trustee's office, complaining about, usually it's their own attorney, complaining about the manner in which so-and-so on the other side is not entering into a reaffirmation agreement in good faith, or whatever it happens to be. I would imagine that you can draw your own conclusions about what kind of misconduct you're going to see in bankruptcy cases. Largely, it's the same type of attorney misconduct you're going to see in criminal cases, in family cases, in immigration cases, in patent cases, whatever it happens to be. Neglect, not diligently handling the case, and you can, again, I'll just say fill in the blanks, and the outline has some examples of how that might come to pass in a bankruptcy case. Communication issues, not communicating clearly, not answering questions and responding to requests for information. Attorneys just don't always tell their clients what's going on or do a very good job of it. Also, as in the example that I mentioned where somebody might call a few times in a short period of time, at least I believe that people have pretty unrealistic expectations these days of instant gratification. When you drive through Taco Bell and you don't get your whatever in 25 seconds, you get kind of ticked off because it's supposed to happen like this. And if you know your attorney has a cell phone, and if you know that she texts, and if you know you're leaving messages at their office, my God, it's been 8 hours. Why hasn't she called me back? What's going on? And so you get a lot of communication issues that result perhaps from a client's unreasonable expectation. And that in turn perhaps results from an attorney's failure to properly educate his or her client and sit them down and tell them what to expect and tell them how often they're going to hear about their case and tell them how reactive the attorney will be to client questions. And if you do that stuff at the outset, if you, you know, come to a meeting of the minds on the rules of engagement, so to speak, you're going to have a lot better client communication and hopefully less grievances. And less grievances is good for me because that means less work and I can someday put my feet up on the desk and start eating bonbons like I thought I'd be able to 17 years ago, but it ain't happened yet. I've really been monologuing here a lot, Jack, and I don't know you. Did some of the examples we gave under confidence or dishonesty or these things, does that ring true of what you see here at the bankruptcy center?
Well, I mean, I can see how, you know, there might be some complaints about communication issues with failure to return phone calls and, you know, failure to keep a client properly informed about their case. I actually have a couple questions for you about, and I think other people would be interested in knowing this too. Going back to the procedure, how it actually works in the time a grievance is filed, there's an investigation, and then there's, you know, probable cause is found, and it proceeds to the trial. That's a trial, it's not in front of the Supreme Court. There's a referee that's appointed.
Yeah, they don't want to act as fact finders. I mean, they want to retain their status as an appellate court. It's a court of review. So the court appoints a referee. They have a permanent-ish panel of 32 referees right now. And they will appoint, and often these are reserve judges. Occasionally they're experienced attorneys, experienced in litigation. And usually from the general geographic area, so that we're not sending people all over the state. Because I could be prosecuting somebody in Superior. You don't want to have a you don't want to have Dennis Flynn from Racine have to handle the case. The cases are tried really as civil cases. The rules of civil procedure are followed. The rules of evidence are followed. There's a fair amount of motion practice. There's a fair amount of discovery. Unfortunately, it sometimes gets into the scorched earth discovery where somebody, you know, this is about a decade ago, but I mean, I've had somebody shake their finger in my face and say, we are going to bury you. Our resources are so much greater than you. My client is prepared to spend $300,000 to $400,000 defending this case. And I'm thinking, well, crap, I got a couple of people with me in the office in-house and I can farm this out to my retained counsel. At a below market rate, and they're not going to be happy. But you know, we don't get outworked. That was fine. We just kept working through that, and you know, kind of like the rock rolling downhill. Once a complaint is filed, it will be litigated. The Supreme Court will come to some kind of a decision. So what happens is there's not a jury, but the referee acts as with the powers of a civil judge, basically a circuit court judge, following. Rules of Civil Procedure, meaning the Wisconsin statutory, state rules of civil procedure. And if you have a trial, the referee issues a report. The difference is that the referee's reports are not an adjudication. It's really more of an advisory report. Their findings of fact get great deference, but the conclusions of law are really something that's reviewed de novo as is the sanction recommendation. And nobody is disciplined until the Supreme Court issues that final order. And that's when you read about them on page 54 of your Wisconsin lawyer someday. Each party can appeal as a matter of right, and many attorneys do. We very, very seldom do, unless we think the referee's report is very, very wrong or going to create bad law somehow. And sometimes there's oral arguments. So.
Okay. And then what about costs? If an attorney loses, are costs always?
Well, the court has a general policy when discipline is imposed, it's codified in one of their SCRs, one of their Supreme Court rules, of imposing all the costs of the proceeding, which, and this makes the bile rise in some respondents, some defendants' throats, but includes the cost of prosecution. Once the case is assigned to somebody, $70 an hour, the costs are charged back to the respondent attorney, includes the judge. Oddly, the referees are paid about $56 an hour because it's based on a breakdown of the per diem rate for reserve judges in Wisconsin. And court reporting, which is just expensive as hell nowadays. And whatever else may come up as far as those costs. If an attorney, and we don't use this as a leverage, it's just fair. if an attorney chooses to stipulate to a lot of the charges or facts or what have you, that's going to reduce the amount of issues that, you know, if we're going to contest a trial, it's going to bring down the costs. We don't plea bargain, which isn't, again, excuse my language, sir, on this. Sorry, Judge Kelly, it's not because we're just trying to play hard-ass prosecutor. It's because the Supreme Court sits down with us. I and my boss, the director, Keith Salina, are having lunch with seven members of the court in the next month. And as they have every year, they're going to say, and you're not plea bargaining, are you? Because it's our understanding and wish that you do not plea bargain. We'd rather have the case brought before our referees. We'd rather have the opportunity to see it on review than have, you know, than have you dolts make a decision to dump cases or to see how it can go. They don't exactly put it that way. All the time. But that means that we have a lot of trials. I mean, that means that when there is some issue that's contested, we contest it and we go ahead and litigate the matter. So I've gone on and on, Jack, but that kind of answers it. It's like civil litigation. You do wind up before the Supreme Court. They're very actively engaged. They're very interested. If you have an oral argument, they're all asking questions. And although I think everybody would prefer, the court would prefer to see per curiam opinions to really speak with one voice on these ethical matters, there have been a number of cases that have concurrences and dissents, such also. You know, so I said, hey, what do you guys want to talk about when I come there? And you had said, well, there's a couple of instances that can come up. One of them that's maybe becoming a little bit more prevalent is the idea of unbundling, and the other one is it's kind of a disclosure of assets and an attorney's duty to tell on her client or tell on another attorney or do something if maybe it seems like everything isn't kosher, that the information that's being presented to a forum or somewhere isn't consistent with what they know to be true. And so we put a couple of those instances in our outline, basically questions or instance, and then some applicable rules, and there was a case cited. And that's really between pages 3 and 6 of the outline. Do you think that that's something that occurs, Jack, where the debtor's attorney has a client that does not want to disclose his assets, his income?
Because this is a question that seems to come up all the time. The first question is, what should a debtor's attorney do when a client does not want to disclose assets? And we put two ethical rules in the outline that would seem to apply here. And this is a tough question. It's not so cut and dry. For example, if you have a client, it seems like a run-of-the-mill case, a Chapter 7, they don't have very many assets, everything seems to happen. You file the case with them. 2 weeks after you file this Chapter 7, you find out they have, let's say $300,000 in a bank account somewhere. And you tell your client, you say, hey, look, you have to disclose this. And the client says, no, I don't want to. And if you do disclose it to anybody, I'm going to report you to OLR because you owe a duty of confidentiality. So you're put in a tough predicament. What do you do? And I think if you look only to Rule 1.6, which is on page 3, and if you read 1.6b alone, it seems that disclosure is mandatory, and you have to disclose the bank account if there's going to be substantial injury to the financial interest or property of another. So just reading that, is a factual issue. You have to see if there's substantial injury. So it would seem like you have to see, you have to look at the injury, look and see how severe it would be. And if it would rise to the level of substantial injury, 1.6 seems to say that you do have a duty to disclose. Bill, is that your take on this as well?
You know, it can be. There. Yeah, I think you put your finger on the essential part of 1.6, which is the confidentiality rule. And the ethics rules, and it would be wonderful to categorize, everything is either red or green. this is what you do. You never say a word that a client says to you, ever, ever, no matter what. Well, that would be a very clear rule and provide excellent guidance. But because the rules have to be applied to real life circumstances, they're not written that way. They're written in a way that is most efficient and most fair, I guess, when applied to those circumstances. And so it says, well, there's sometimes you're going to have to say stuff. You're going to have to make disclosures. And one of them, as you mentioned, is when there's a mandatory disclosure. But that's only if the lawyer says, I have a reasonable belief, that this will prevent a client from committing criminal or fraudulent acts. And that act would cause substantially bodily harm or substantial injury to the financial interest. So those are some wiggle rooms. And that's why we end up litigating cases. Well, I didn't think it would really substantial interest if I didn't disclose that account. And so you get into some of those situations. But if you read 1.6, and particularly A, don't talk about information relating to the representation of a client. You've got a duty of loyalty to your client. We all know that. It's kind of ingrained. It's very fundamental. It's what the clients believe. Just like when they tell their doctor something personal and confidential, they think perhaps telling the lawyer something personal and confidential is a safe harbor. And then in response to this question, though, we haven't just listed that duty of loyalty and the somewhat limited mandatory disclosure. On the top of page 4, we said, hey, the lawyer also has duties, really higher duties, to justice and to a court. And in particular, and these rules are longer, we're not going to be, we could spend an hour talking about one rule. More like clicking like butterflies from one topic to another here. If you look at sub C, SCR 23.3, it says, you know what? Some of these duties apply where a lawyer cannot hide this stuff. Even if compliance requires disclosure of information otherwise protected by the confidentiality rule.
So basically it's saying that rule 3.3 trumps the duty of confidentiality.
Yes, if this were written in sheepshead talk, it would say duty to the court trumps your duty to the client, at least insofar as making particularly material false statements goes, as far as hiding information or allowing information to be brought before the court. Attorney didn't do anything, I just sat and listened. You can't just sit and listen if somebody's providing false testimony and you know it to be true and you know it's going to cause a substantial harm to the financial interest of another. That type of thing would require disclosure ultimately to the court. Now there are steps you take. You remonstrate with your client. You do it, really. Tell the truth. And then there's some other things that you can try to do. You can try to see what can occur to allow the representation to continue in a way that meets the needs of both the client or the court. But ultimately, if you got to choose client or court for these material substantial injury situations, you've got to be true to the court.
Yeah, and I think, and I'm not saying it applies for sure, but it's 3.3A1. It says a lawyer shall not make a false statement of fact or law the tribunal or fail to correct a false statement of material fact. I think in the case of, where there's a bankruptcy file, the bankruptcy petition, a lawyer isn't the one who's made an overt statement, hiding an asset, but he or she signed the petition. And under 707B4, the signature of an attorney on the petition constitutes a certification that the attorney has no knowledge after an inquiry that the information in the schedules is incorrect. So I think there's an argument there saying that these schedules that the attorney signed and filed, they might constitute a statement. I know, Bill, you said A3 might be more applicable here.
So if I'm appearing before Judge Kelly, sub A says, well, you can't lie to her, or you previously said something and it's false, you got to correct it. A3 basically says I cannot offer evidence I know to be false. I can't offer it through a client that's testifying. I can't offer it through any other witness I might call before the judge. And if I come to know of its falsity, I've got to try to take these remedial measures, or I've got to do something. There's a little bit of an exclusion for certain circumstances in criminal cases. But, you know, if somebody else calls a witness and I know of its falsity, and to tell that falsity would somehow be disloyal to my client and would require me to disclose confidential information that doesn't maybe meet the standard of disclosure, then maybe I don't want to. So again, these rules are very fact specific, I guess I'd say, or ethical application, very fact intensive, as far as what might constitute a violation and what might not. And it's a little frustrating saying, well, the ethics rules are great, because if you act honestly and purely and know the law, you shouldn't really have any ethical issues. But as a practical matter, you sometimes find yourself, you know, walking in the bog trying to figure out, is this really substantial personal thing, or if it's not my client, she called the client, I'm kind of like, you know, or is this my statement when I did the certification, even though my client signed the schedules?
Yeah, those are issues that come up.
We mentioned unbundling. I mentioned unbundling. I know a bit about limited scope agreements, but not a whole ton. But there was a very lengthy and I think very illuminative case that recently came out in Nevada. And it's, I don't know if it's Sear or Sire, but I didn't know one heck of a lot more about that case, I think, Jack, than I do. It's a case in which a court spoke to an attorney's attempt to severely limit the scope of his representation. And
what
happened?
Okay. And I know we talked about unbundling just briefly a few weeks ago at the annual update, but it seems to be a hot issue right now. Unbundling in general is growing in the legal profession, and in particular in bankruptcy and family law cases. So that's why I just wanted to go over the Sear case. It's very long, as Bill indicated. It's about 49 pages in the dual column print. And it is out of the District of Nevada. The attorney who was sanctioned did appeal this case. He appealed it to the bankruptcy appellate panel, the Ninth Circuit. There's been no decision yet, but this decision, the bankruptcy decision, is published. So right now it's good law, and it seems to be the most comprehensive decision to date on unbundling. So if you have any issue that comes up in the near future with regard to that, definitely take a look at this case.
Is that in your outline, Jack? Or?
Yeah, it's on page 4.
Okay.
But before I get to the facts of this case, I just want to point out the district differences that we have here in Wisconsin. Here in the Eastern District, we have Local Rule 9010. It basically says that an attorney who appears in a main case is presumed to represent a party in an adversary unless there is notice to the party represented and by leave of the court. So if you're representing a debtor who is sued in an adversary proceeding, you're presumed to represent that debtor in the adversary unless you withdraw. And might be mistaken about this, but I think you don't have to file a motion to withdraw, you can do it by stipulation and order. I mean, I think I've seen that done.
Yeah.
I think the
opposite. You just didn't not show up for the pretrial and say, in my 2019 or whatever it is, I said I wasn't including adversary proceedings, so I'm not including it. We just want to be sure that your client knows that you're not representing them in the adversary.
And we don't want to go hunting all over the place to see who to call.
Right.
Okay. And I think in the Western District,
it's the opposite. In an adversary action, a debtor is listed as pro se until an attorney files a notice of appearance. And this is how it is in all districts around the country. There's, you know, it's different everywhere. So going back to the Sear case, the attorney that was sanctioned here, like I said, he did appeal this case. And if you do read this case, keep in mind that the Nevada Rules of Professional Conduct
they adopted this, the ABA model rules, so their rules are exactly the same, pretty much, as Wisconsin's rules, even the numbers. So there's really no difference when you're reading it with regard to the rules. So the facts in that case, the debtors were joint debtors, husband and wife, and back in 2010, the husband sued his former employer, who was a hospital. The hospital's name was St. Rose. It was an employment discrimination case. So he filed this case in federal district court. During the course of litigation, he fabricated some emails that, you know, that the court discovered. Short of the line, the district court dismissed his lawsuit and ordered him to pay the hospital's attorney's fees of about $67,000. The court found that he conducted litigation in bad faith, and what he did amounted to a fraud upon the court. So the hospital got a judgment against him. They started garnishing their wages. So then the debtors went to Mr. DeLuca, who's a bankruptcy attorney in Las Vegas. So they went to see him at about 5 o'clock one night. It was late in the day, and they wanted to file a Chapter 7 case. You know, so they were there at his office. They had their two kids. They had a short meeting with Attorney DeLuca, and he told them, you know, that everything was pretty much dischargeable. And it's not clear if he just assumed that this debt that was owed to the hospital was for medical services. He didn't pay enough attention to realize that, you know, this was probably a debt that was going to be found fraudulent in bankruptcy court. So again, it was 5 o'clock at night. They were rushed. He didn't pay enough attention, most likely, which is what the court found. After the short meeting that the debtors had with the attorney, the debtors were put into a separate room, and they were told to look through a 19-page retainer agreement and then sign wherever they needed to, and they needed to initial every paragraph. So they did that. The retainer agreement that they signed, it went through basic services that were included in the attorney's $2,000 flat fee. The basic services included things like analyzing the debtor's financial situation, preparing the petition, and then, you know, appearing at the 341 meeting. There was also a section in the retainer agreement that discussed additional fees, and it specifically said adversary proceedings are not included as part of this $2,000 flat fee. So, you know, the attorney thought he had all his bases covered. This is a boilerplate form that he used in pretty much all his bankruptcy cases that he took on.
Was this an experienced guy, Jack?
Yeah, he had a lot of experience. Okay. He had, it was 10, 15 years of experience, I believe. So the attorney filed the Chapter 7 petition about 2 weeks later. The hospital appeared at the 341 meeting, and it expressed its intent of filing an adversary to determine dischargeability. The adversary was then filed, and the debtor's attorney informed them that he would not be representing them in the adversary proceeding. So the debtors filed their pro se answer. The court held a scheduling conference, and the debtors told the court, well, you know, my attorney's not here because he told us that he doesn't consider adversary proceedings as something he should be helping us with because it's not part of his $2,000 fee. So the court didn't like that. It issued an order to show cause why Attorney DeLuca should not be sanctioned for not representing the debtors in the adversary proceeding. So there was an evidentiary hearing held on the order to show cause. The court found that Attorney DeLuca violated several rules of professional conduct. The main one was the duty to provide competent representation. The court said that what you have to look to is whether a lawyer fulfilled the duty of competence depends on the client's objectives. So here, the client's main objective when they went to go see Attorney DeLuca was to have this garnishment stopped. And of course, because it's non-dischargeable and they filed, you know, Chapter 7, the garnishment would go on after discharge. The court said that the bundle of services that an attorney needs to provide, it needs to include whatever is needed to achieve the client's anticipated results. The court also pointed out that the duty of competence survives any limitation on the scope of services. So basically, the fact that the attorney had this very thorough retainer agreement, which, you know, said adversary proceedings are not part of my flat fee, you're on your own for them. That didn't matter. And then, Bill, you had a pretty good analogy yesterday when we talked
about this. It's because I'm perpetually trying to dumb things down so that I can understand them. But I would, you know, what I understand this case to be basically is that there's this limitation in this overwrought 19-page retainer agreement, and sure, the client consented. There's a question about whether it was informed consent, and the limitation just wasn't reasonable under the circumstances with regard to what the client wanted. And I said, you know, it strikes me that decision, and I only read like page 42 of it because that related to the rules, but the decision seems to be discussing somebody as if they were maybe a plaintiff's PI, personal injury attorney, who says, yeah, I'll handle your case, you know, we'll do it, we'll do everything, blah, blah, blah. But, you know, I'm not going to deal with expert witnesses. I'm just not going to. So we're going to have to carve that out of the agreement, and you'll have to pay me extra if you want me to do anything with expert testimony or expert witnesses. And you can't often handle a personal injury case without that very fundamental, essential, integrated element. And in these circumstances as well, I think that the court found, as they sanctioned Mr. DeLuca, that you know, the limitation just wasn't reasonable. It just wasn't reasonable in terms of the scope and the expectations of the client and what the client or clients wanted in that case.
Yeah, the other main rule that the court found was violated was 1.2C, which deals with scope of representation. Unbundling of legal services is only okay if it's reasonable under the circumstances and if the client gives informed consent. So here the court said not representing the debtor in that adversary because it didn't achieve the goal that the debtor wanted for filing the bankruptcy, that wasn't met. And the client did not give informed consent here. The court said that the debtors, even though they went through that 19-page agreement, initial W paragraph, and signed where they needed to, that was not informed consent. Ryan, you have a question?
Do you think it's going to be limited precedent, if only because most debtors who come in to file bankruptcy aren't necessarily trying to discharge one gigantic debt, whereas they're trying to clear out a whole slew of debts, and you're not going to see most times.
I mean, I think so. I think it would be of limited precedential value because I think all these cases where an attorney's sanctioned, I think they're very fact-specific. I think here, you know, the court found that this attorney was negligent for not looking through all the paperwork. The debtors even gave him a copy of the judgment from district court, and he didn't look through it to see that, you know, it was a debt that would probably be found to be fraudulent.
I think the problem with Bill's analogy is, and I did do personal injury cases, but I would think expert witnesses are probably going to be a part of over half, over 75%, over 90% of a PI case, whereas this kind of claim is maybe 10% of the people that walk into your office have a problem with a non-dischargeable debt. So I'm not sure that it holds up.
Right, or put differently, if you reasonably thought, you know, your PI case could be done without experts, and then it turned out you get, you know, down the road and you've got a withdrawal problem maybe, but you know, this happens to be the odd case where you need to have somebody else handle the experts. I don't know, I'm not sure that's unreasonable ex ante. It seems to me that this case, if the person, I presume, had flagged this issue, counsel had flagged this issue and say, look, you might have a problem with this, and the debtor had said, that's okay, I want to proceed anyways, seems like it comes out differently.
That's a discussion and probably a real, true, informed consent of the situation. Hey, I think in this case there's reference also to the fact of, well, the client's read and signed off on, you know, he's really having people sign off on stuff. He wasn't discussing it with them so much. Putting them in a room, taking these complicated documents. They also read and signed off on a frequently asked questions recital that he had.
We also see it a lot of the times when the only debt is, say, a big student loan. And so the real reason for filing the bankruptcy is to have that adversary proceeding to find undue hardship on the student loan. And if the attorney lets them go through and goes ahead and files the bankruptcy without really analyzing the real reason for filing the bankruptcy, which is what happened here, then that's really what you need to focus. Why are you filing? The whole purpose of it.
And it seems like for those that are that have this clientele that has unemployment, overpayments, these mm-hmm. things that we used to call them David Lang specials because he was the attorney for DWD that was always in, but now it's Andy Rubsum. So you're mm-hmm. sitting with somebody who's was out of work and got unemployment. I think you have to say to them, hey, you got a potential non-dischargeable debt here, and I'll do your bankruptcy, but I am not going to fight with the state
and
over this. And you need to have a conversation about that, not just hand them a piece of paper and say this is our standard contract. That seems like from
yeah.
this case it would be good advice to do. I mean, I don't think there's a problem with not representing them against Andy Rubsum mm-hmm. as long as the client has that expectation. Oh, I knew he wasn't gonna. I knew she wasn't gonna be with me here today. I still wanna fight it, etc. Do you agree or?
Yeah, but I think you've got to do the inquiry at the beginning. What do you want out of this bankruptcy? Why are you filing?
Yeah.
And if the debtor says, oh, I owe a bunch of money to DWD, then you got to tell them, hey, this bankruptcy may not do it for you.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right. But to Susan's point, even if they said, in this case, right, they say, oh, yeah, the reason I want to file bankruptcy is because I want to get out of this fraud mm-hmm. judgment. And the person says, well, that's going to require, to battle out this adversary, and I'm not going to do that for you for $2,000. And the person says, well, I'm going to pay you $2,000. I'll go it alone on that. At that point, as long as everybody knows what the deal is, I don't know that's
particularly
problematic.
If that was an issue that was flagged up, up front, and the attorney did more than just, throw these clients into a room and have them sign the retainer agreement, if he explained it, prepared something more detailed, specific to the situation. I mm-hmm. think this may have gone another way.
Yeah.
We're kind of running out of time, and I think we probably want to get to some interesting stories that Bill has.
I can do that. And the other thing is that I'm going to go back to DeLuca just to circle back. He's asserting that my retainer overrides a lot of these rules. Because it's a contract,
mm.
And sure, attorneys in Wisconsin can say they have a non-refundable fee, but put it in your retainer agreement. The truth is, there is no such thing. The attorney said basically, and we see this a lot in disciplinary cases: no harm, no foul. Well, that might mitigate a sanction, but it doesn't mean there wasn't an ethical problem. This guy really went to the mat on the case. He was actually arguing that there was a constitutional issue. Because he would be forced to provide services that weren't bargained for, and he had a right to be free from involuntary servitude. So, I mean, he's arguing slavery against the bankruptcy judge who's just trying to get his clients adequate representation in the case. With regard to the lawyer misconduct cases that are listed, again, they're not listed to embarrass anybody or if anybody's related to people or know or have worked in the office of these folks. It's just to be illustrative of the kind of things that come up in bankruptcy cases. And I will very quickly spin through some of the Wisconsin cases, but just to reemphasize the point I made at the beginning, that we get 100-plus grievances with regard to bankruptcy law at OLR every year, year in and year out. Now already, after 11 months of the year or so, we've had 6-7 cases in which Wisconsin attorneys have been found to have committed misconduct specifically in the context of bankruptcy matters and of representing clients in bankruptcy. The Mary Beester case was about much more. There were like 30 counts, but one of the counts was somebody paying a retainer and she's not depositing this advanced fee into trust. It's a trust account violation. Not setting aside amounts in a trust account for costs, that's a trust account violation. Ultimately, she filed and asked for a waiver of the filing fee and didn't get it, didn't tell the client, that's a communication issue. The court dismissed the case, didn't tell the client, that's a communication issue and a diligence issue. And that's the kind of things that we see with regard to, occasionally with regard to some people in bankruptcy matters, some who concentrate on it, and some who dabble in it.
You know, it's dangerous to be a, you know, jack of all trades but master of none and handle things that are beyond your competence. I certainly would struggle with anything beyond the most rudimentary Chapter 7 if I were asked to represent anybody in this court these days, without an awful lot of boning up on the topic so that I could meet those competency requirements. Joan Boyd had just a string of cases, and she's had a string of disciplines. Some were regarding criminal defense. A number of them were bankruptcy. And here's a Chapter 13. She incompetently advised her clients to file it. They just wanted to keep a truck, and they just absolutely did not have the resources or the ability to put together any kind of a plan that would have been okayed. She got suspended, and she wasn't telling clients, and she wasn't telling the courts that her license was suspended or was about to be. She took a bunch of money to file a bankruptcy and filed it like the day before she was going to get suspended. She knew that was going to happen because the Supreme Court told her a few weeks in advance, your license is toast as of, you know, June 1st of whatever year, and various other misconduct. Mr. Engel's a sad and distasteful story for his primary misconduct. There was some kind of secondary misconduct in addition to sex with kid, and that was in a bankruptcy case. He accepted advanced fees, didn't have a trust account, so he put it in his buddy's trust account. Had no professional affiliation, the client had no affiliation with the person whose trust account the money went into, but there's some very strict rules when you're acting as a fiduciary and we're dealing with what should be trust account funds. I'm sure Bill Ross practices here occasionally, and in this particular case, in one of the cases, he was dealing a lot with referrals from an independent paralegal who would solicit clients that were facing foreclosure. And the attorney here was not meeting with the clients at the outset, documentation wasn't all getting submitted, and part of the case involved that attorney agreeing not to take any more referrals from that particular paralegal. Walter Stern was actually convicted for money laundering, but what happened is there was a marital settlement agreement and there were payments coming in, and Stern was basically hiding that money and then referred the person that he was dealing with, client and friend, to a bankruptcy attorney without telling the bankruptcy attorney what's going on. And then she files a Chapter 7 and gets a discharge on a no asset case when she actually had like some $90,000 coming in under the marital settlement agreement. He pled no contest and allowed the factual allegations of our disciplinary complaint to be used as a factual basis for the findings of misconduct. The court found misconduct. The court, meaning the Wisconsin Supreme Court, that's the only court I'm oriented toward, really. They suspended his license for a couple of years. And then, interestingly, his underlying conviction was actually overturned by the Seventh Circuit on an issue of allowing him to testify as to certain information. And so things are a little up in the air, but like a guy named Nick Herchin, who similarly, he was revoked for a criminal conviction down in Illinois, and later on the Illinois was found to be unconstitutional, and so the conviction was vacated. The discipline still stands, because the discipline is based upon a stipulation and an agreement as to some certain facts, and at least Mr. Stern has not made an effort to change or overturn that. Now, I included Charlotte Spadaro, and like a lot of the things and pages on here, I could talk about these folks for an hour. Some of the attorneys, and you could probably think of some you've run into in your careers, really do some wacky stuff.
She's not a Wisconsin attorney.
Charlotte, no, she's a former Beverly Hills mayor. She was previously disciplined, and I was telling war stories about her at a national convention in San Francisco a few years ago. Well, she's back. Well, she's back and she's out. She's disbarred now. There are about five or six forms of misconduct, and some of them actually involve bankruptcy, so I included the story, but you know, she's having her clients sign blank bankruptcy forms and delivering them to her at a dog boarding kennel. She's having the paralegals do the forms. And when the forms are wrong and deficient, she hired another paralegal to do the forms because she herself was not, I don't think, capable of doing them competently. The second paralegal was a disbarred attorney. You just can't run your business that way. She neglected the bankruptcy. The bankruptcy is dismissed. She winds up suing the clients for fees. She also had issues with...
Class.
Yeah. And the clients were filed for arbitration. By the way, if you ever, and gosh knows, you're U.S. citizens, you have every right to pursue your, you know, redress in a court of law. If you're going to sue a client for fee, make sure you really deserve it and know that you want to do that, because there is no quicker way to get an OLR grievance, meritorious or not, accusing you of neglecting, doing a poor job, wearing the wrong clothes, whatever it happens to be, than suing somebody for fees, because that's one of the ways a client can get back at you. But Ms. Spadaro is an animal hoarder. She there's issues about that. She led on residents of a mobile home court, very vulnerable people. Give me $1,000 apiece for a class action case until we're going to get you $1 million. We're going to get you $1 million. It was unfiled. She tried to have a client file it pro se, and it just didn't work out. There was an amazing story about her son and borrowing a car from a client, and the car wound up being vandalized, and Spadaro herself didn't even have a license. Just a whole realm of misconduct spanning the panoply of human poor behavior. And I see that our time has run out. I really appreciate to Jack being here and having the chance to talk to you all about this stuff, and I will be around for a little bit if anybody wants to hang out and say hey.
Thanks so much to Bill and Jack. And in the remote locations, if you want to drop Paul an email, she'll get you on the list. And again, come back in February. Don't come back in January. We're skipping January, but in February we're back. Weed stripping part two. Hope to see you.
That was really good.
January.
Okay.
Thanks. I, you know.